Some 30 years after Fraser died at the age of 87, his one-time secretary, R.A. Downey, who was provoked to defend him against presumptuous younger critics, among whom he singled out the Professor of Social Anthropology in Oxford, E. Evans Pritchard. "But anthropologists are a queer tribe," Downey wrote, and since 1948, when Evans Pritchard gave his lecture on the divine kingship of the Shilluk, it has become almost traditional in Fraser lectures to take some idea of Fraser's and pull it to pieces. Downey exaggerates, but it's true that some later lecturers have followed a brief conventional acknowledgement of Fraser's undoubted eminence by papers which implicitly raise doubts about whether or why he deserved it. And even now, a century after Golden Bough was first published, and half a century after Fraser's death, Fraser of the Golden Bough still remains, if only by name, by far the most widely known of all British social anthropologists. Whether they like it or not, Fraser's popular reputation remains part of their own. And since he raised the question of posterity, it seems appropriate to take the occasion of these anniversaries to look back on some of the verdicts that have been passed on his work, for the most part by those outside the small circle of distinguished fellows who were scholars who were his friends. The first full-scale biography of Fraser didn't appear until 1987. Robert Ackerman's J.D. Fraser, His Life and Work, draws upon most published and many hitherto unpublished sources to bring to life Fraser's character and intellectual interests, and he had very few others, in relation both to his own times and to ours. If I add little more to that book than a few asides from my own anthropological viewpoint, I have two excuses. The first is that my DPhil thesis in Oxford was examined and approved by the Reverend E.O. James, who was born in 1888, and who is described by Ackerman as the last of the true believing Fraserians, and he was kind enough to suppose that at heart I shared his faith. The second is that before Ackerman thought of writing his book, I also had taken an interest in some of Fraser's unpublished letters, or rather unpublished letters to Fraser, when they first began to arrive here in Trinity College, jumbled together in a few old cardboard boxes. And I have made use of a few which Ackerman disregarded. Handling those personal letters gave an intimate impression of the fascination Fraser's work had exercised over correspondents of all kinds from all over the world, and the respect and deference, even veneration, accorded to this shy, reclusive, and personally far from charismatic scholar, seemed to call for some explanation. Even as first-year students of anthropology in the mid-40s, we were allowed to assume, to put it bluntly, that Fraser was a bore, if on a grand scale. And he certainly wrote at inordinate length, as you may judge from one or two passages I am bound to quote. Fraser could scarcely have hoped for a more sympathetic biographer than Ackerman, but even he introduces his subject with the intentionally challenging statement, "Fraser is an embarrassment." And Ackerman knows that this has been particularly true for social anthropologists, who have to agree that Fraser was and remains the most famous of them all, while also dissociating themselves from much that he wrote. He embarrasses us partly for the very reason which gave him his wider popular appeal, his apparent sympathy, that is, with the assumptions and values of his own times and social class. Though he often appears to accept those values, while also obliquely suggesting their limitations, he never, unlike Matthew Arnold, whom he in some ways resembles, directly confronts them. It is not necessary, therefore, to read very far in his work to find examples of the imperialism, paternalism, colonial mentality, and now certainly elitism, which some critics of British social anthropology still detect in his successors, like the sins of their colonialist fathers, inexorably visited upon their children, innocent though they may claim to be. And of course, those people whose grandparents Fraser constantly refers to as savages, "your dear savages," one of his clerical admirers called them, do not like it the better for knowing that Fraser included not only his own remote ancestors in that category, but also most of his living fellow countrymen. "The masses everywhere are constituted," he wrote, "a solid layer of savagery beneath the surface of society." When Fraser died in 1941, Professor Fleur's obituary for the Royal Society, she wrote to allow for some of Fraser's comments on the common people, which might be misunderstood in the more democratic atmosphere of the nation at war. As an example, he quoted a Fraserian passage which ends with a reference to, I quote, the empty husks of superstition on which the swine of modern society are still content to feed. We are not, I think, quite reassured when Fleur then adds, needless to say, swine is used here without any touch of unkindness. Fraser was in principle sympathetic towards the underprivileged, but he could never resist a turn of phrase or a biblical quotation or allusion. And these are questions of change in general social sensitivities as between Fraser's times and ours. But among the smaller literary and academic public who take Fraser's social attitudes for granted as part of the history of ideas familiar to their own parents or grandparents, the part assigned to Fraser in the history of 20th century ideas and sentiments, in the history of modern Western sensibility, to use the word in my title, is disproportionate to the much smaller part he soon came to play in the history of social anthropology. And as his influence on so many of this century's creative writers shows, he provided general readers with more food for the imagination and more colourful and stylized prose than his successors usually had to offer. Some 30 years ago, when I lectured on Fraser at the Jung Institute in Zurich, I criticized Fraser's interpretation of primitive religion more dismissively than I would now, suggesting that his ideas of primitive psychology were little more than plausible constructs of his own Victorian rationalism. The lecture was not at all well received by the students and members of the Institute, who preferred to admire him as a guide to the understanding of the human psyche, an imaginative pioneer in the exploration of Jungian archetypes. T.S. Eliot similarly found the Golden Bough psychologically complementary to the work of Freud, throwing light, said Eliot, on the obscurities of the soul from a different angle. I should have been better advised in Zurich to remember the line of Yeats, whose interest in Fraser was similar to those of the psychoanalysts: tread softly, for you tread on my dreams. Fraser, in several passages, sees himself as Prospero, appealing to his reader's sense of the illusions, transience, and mystery of dreams. Compare, for example, the famous opening of the abridged version of the Golden Bough with that of Ratcliffe Brown's The Andaman Islanders, published in the same year. Fraser begins by promising his readers a voyage of discovery from, he says, Turner's dreamlike vision of the little woodland lake of Nemi, Diana's mirror, as it was called by the ancients, and so on, to the secret of the king of the sacred wood. Ratcliffe Brown begins with a short geography lesson. The Andaman Islands are part of a chain of islands stretching from Cape Negre in Burma to Achin Head in Sumatra. Having myself started a book in the approved, that was the style of Ratcliffe Brown, I now think there may be some happy medium between the sensibility of the one and the science of the other. Among later well-known social anthropologists, perhaps only Levi-Strauss in Tristra Peak, itself a romantic and indeed a deliberately poetic title, and Margaret Mead, in their very different ways, have invited their readers to share their personal anthropological experience in a voyage of self-discovery. Both, like Fraser, are very self-conscious writers, and they write also with an eye to the reader's own self-consciousness. It is clear, as I shall later show, that Fraser's wider public often read him less for anthropological knowledge of very foreign peoples than because he encouraged them to think about themselves and to find themselves more interesting and exciting than they had supposed themselves to be. When he received an honorary degree at Manchester University, to take a small example, he told the Mancunians that in their city, I quote, the pulse of life, the pulse of empire, beats more strongly than in the peaceful, the cloistered seclusion of our ancient universities. Manchester ranks with Athens and Alexandria in antiquity and with Florence in the Middle Ages. When Rudyard Kipling invited Fraser to accept yet another of his honorary degrees from the University of St. Andrews in 1923, he addressed him as one to whom our civilization owes so much of its knowledge of itself and to mark the recent centenary of the Golden Bough, some well-known modern writers and critics have on the whole confirmed Fritz Kipling's judgment with reference to Fraser's influence on thinkers, I can't think of another word, and creative writers during this century. Some of it of a kind he would probably have preferred not to acknowledge. D.H. Lawrence and James Joyce, for example, had he taken any interest in them, would have shocked or baffled him, and he soon found Eliot's The Wasteland absolutely incomprehensible. With his fear of working-class Bolshevism and his primness about sex, he would have been dismayed to find himself remembered in the company of Marx and Freud as one of the makers of our modern consciousness. But there are many other representatives of our modern consciousness, Mrs. Whitehouse, for example, with whom he would have felt quite at home. He denounced an age like ours, this was in 1922, I may say, when marriage and family ties counted for nothing. Sexual communism was commonly taken for granted, and the very distinction between the sexes was being obliterated. At such a time, he suggested unrealistically, we should do well to contemplate the domestic virtues of the poet William Cowper. In order, he said, to repel and refute those shallow sophisms which, addressed to the basis of human passions, would subvert the fabric of civilization and plunge us back into that savagery from which it has cost mankind so many generations of patient effort to emerge. Downey, by contrast, mentioned that a passage in Fraser suggesting that science itself might be superseded by some quite different mode of understanding had been quoted by the drug culture of the 1960s as a prophecy of psychedelic insight. It's ironical that Fraser, a model of middle-class morality and social conformity, should have been accepted as the herald of later intellectual and emotional emancipation. For social anthropologists, on the other hand, Fraser had started to belong to the past almost at the same time as these Fraser lectures were established. In 1922, simultaneously with the publication of the first abridged edition of The Golden Bough, came Malinowski's Argonauts of the Western Pacific and Ratcliffe Brown's The Andaman Islanders, which I have mentioned, the first outstanding examples of the British fieldwork, which Fraser had very actively encouraged. As every first-year student knows, these monographs began to point students towards empirical studies of Fraser's savages who, when actually spoken to, were found to have much more of interest to say for themselves than Fraser had to say about them. The central theme, or as he thought, theory of the Golden Bough, that all mankind had evolved intellectually and psychologically from a superstitious belief in magicians through a superstitious belief in priests and gods, an enlightened belief in scientists, had little or no relevance to the conduct of life in an Andamanese camp or a Melanesian village, and the whole supposedly scientific basis of Fraser's anthropology was seen as a misapplication of Darwin's theory of biological evolution to human history and psychology. This, of course, is an absurdly simplified account of what happened with the change from library research to field research, but it is enough to suggest why, among social anthropologists, Fraser's reputation declined so rapidly after he had first made it. And for a younger generation, there were, of course, other more personal reasons, as, for example, Evans Pritchard explained. He wrote, I began to vary the tedium of the history school at Oxford by taking an interest in books like Tylor's Primitive Culture and Fraser's The Golden Bough. But there was a snag. I didn't want to become, I was going to say, just an intellectual. I wanted a life of adventure too, and fieldwork seemed to be a solution to both. Fraser's immediate successors were, of course, still as committed as Fraser was himself to establishing the scientific credentials of their subject, but though their science was to be a social science, for Malinowski a science of culture, for Ratcliffe Brown a natural science of society, their model for this science, like Fraser's, was taken from the natural sciences. The great thinkers, the Newtons and Darwins of anthropology, will come after us, Fraser had written, and they are still awaited, though Ratcliffe Brown sometimes seemed to hope that he might be one of them. It must be remembered, of course, that funding for research was more readily forthcoming then as now, in the name of the sciences than in the name of the arts. Lévi-Strauss has recently said, in doubts raised about the empirical foundations of his structuralism, that the great speculative structures are meant to be broken. But I cannot think that he now regards all structuralist interpretations to be entirely misconceived. In a paradoxical way, for an influential anthropologist to make such a statement disarms particular criticisms of his work, and Fraser was, if unconsciously, a master of such tactics. He often reminds his readers that all theories, magical, religious, or scientific, were in the last analysis only theories of thought, as though it mattered little whether they were mistaken or not. I doubt if Fraser meant to erect his speculative structure of the whole evolution of the human intellect from savagery to civilization for the scientific satisfaction of seeing his successors demolish it, but by insisting that all theories of the nature of man and the universe are merely of notional significance, the only facts really count, he appeals to his reader's inclination to expect at their first face value the choice and arrangement of the facts by which he supports his theories. And he does so with overtones particularly calculated to appeal to his contemporaries, brought up on sermons, the Bible, and a biblical view of human ignorance in relation to divine omniscience. All our human theories were, after all, he wrote, merely hypotheses devised to explain the ever-shifting phantasmagoria of thought, which we dignify with the high-sounding names of man and the universe. They were all fated to be washed away like children's castles in the sand by the rising tide of knowledge. It would seem impertinent to ask him what the low-sounding names of man and the universe might be, or whether a scientific or even economic or political theory, if applied with possibly unfortunate consequences, was really no more important than a sand castle. These are typically Fraserian images, and typically, to paraphrase Lévi-Strauss's often quoted remark about totems, he uses them not because they're good to think with, but because they're good for his readers to feel with. The anatomist and physical anthropologist Sir Arthur Keith wrote to Fraser after he had heard Fraser's Huxley lecture that in him, without doubt, the Kirk had lost tip-top preacher as well as a scholar. Fraser was brought up in a tradition which took sermons seriously, and John Dwyer's book, Virtuous Discourse, Sensibility and Community in 18th Century Scotland, often reminds one of this and of others of Fraser's characteristics. The cultivation of a spirit of melancholy, of rational fellow feeling, along with admiration for Addison, Hume, Adam Smith and Malthus. He certainly seemed to derive some satisfaction from his sad reflections on the human condition, spending so much of his time on that melancholy record of human error and folly, as he called it, the golden bough. The voice of the preacher, then, is often echoed in Fraser's writings, and it must seem incongruous sometimes for many modern readers with the voice of the scientist. In what he called a scientific spirit, he writes, "We must endeavour to..." "We must endeavour to investigate the beliefs and customs of mankind with the same rigorous impartiality with which, for example, we investigate the habits of bees and ants." But when he develops his well-known analogy between the magician and the scientist, both attempting to control nature by the application of immutable laws, the voice of the preacher carries him away. Take, for example, the following passage, where a consciousness of human weakness is complemented, as often in sermons, by a message of hope. "Both of them," he says, "the scientist and the magician, open up a boundless vista of possibilities to him who knows the causes of things and can touch the strings that set in motion the vast and intricate mechanism of the world. They lure the weary inquirer, footsore seeker, on through the wilderness of disappointment in the present by their endless promise of the future. They take him to the top of an exceeding high mountain and show him beyond the dark mists and clouds at his feet a vision of the celestial city, far off it may be, but radiant with unearthly splendour, bathed in the light of dreams. One can almost hear the announcement of the hymn that will follow. But for readers accustomed to the language and sentiments of the scriptures, and trying to reconcile them with the scientific authority of Darwin and Herbert Spencer, this amalgamation of the scientific quest and the pilgrim's progress offered a comforting literary resolution. Fraser was offered a civilist was awarded a civilist pension in 1905 in recognition of his literary merits and his anthropological studies in that order, and his literary and biographical essays on Condorcet, for example, on Renan, are admirable of their kind, both in style and content, but it was the more homiletic style of the Golden Bough in which he presented his wide range of knowledge that gave him his public reputation as an anthropologist and brought him a repletion of high academic and public honours. Fraser always addresses his readers directly in a tone of gentle but assured authority, as though no reasonable person could possibly disagree with him. And even those social anthropologists who had been among the first to criticise his ideas had to come to terms with an uneasy sense of his superiority. Max Gluckman, for example, in a Fraser lecture, said that though we no longer found Fraser's basic ideas useful, that we read him at all for antiquarian interest, and that we often found him dull, concluded, however, that we were still, in Gluckman's words, perched upon his shoulders, dwarfs upon a giant. Though it must seem unlikely to those who remember Gluckman that he could ever regard himself as a dwarf, either physically or mentally, it is more than conventional praise. Again, Evans Pritchard, who without Fraser's imaginative construct of divine kinship would probably never have thought of the lecture in which he criticised it, later paid him much the same kind of tribute as Fraser's own contemporaries, describing the Golden Bough as among the great achievements of English literature and scholarship. As late as 1965, Edmund Leach, one of the most impatient critics of Fraser's overblown prose and his literary embellishment of his sources for dramatic effect, concluded an almost entirely hostile account of Fraser's anthropology with the highest praise. It is because each of us can recognise in his pages the savage within us that we feel the excitement of insight, the unverifiable validity of a statement of genius. Again, the primary interest of the savage would seem to be to heighten our own self-consciousness. Leach, however, had a sharp advocate's mind, as some will know, and might equally well have argued for the prosecution along with Wittgenstein that Fraser was much more savage than most of his savages, since his explanations of their observances, said Wittgenstein, are much cruder than the sense of the observances themselves. Fraser, of course, like Wittgenstein, was a fellow of Trinity College, and therefore perhaps should have known better. But Fraser received his honorary DCL in Oxford in the company of Cecil Rhodes and Lord Kitchener, and was writing for a general public which, like them, had very much cruder notions of savages than those which, largely as a result of his own work, began to be entertained after the Great War of 1914-18. There are now very, very few social anthropologists who remember from their own direct experience how and why Fraser came for a time to regard it so highly. Whatever they may have thought of his ideas or personality, for them he was still an authority to be counted with and an original source of some of their own anthropological interests and knowledge. By now he seems a remote ancestral figure, and the Golden Bough has become little more than an intellectual ancient monument, one of the most beautiful ruins in the history of culture. No, history of thought, I'm sorry. One of the most beautiful ruins in the history of thought, Lord Annan called it some 40 years ago. And if we are to understand how Fraser, whose work scarcely any student of social anthropology has actually read for the last 50 years, came to be so eminent, we can do so only by excavating that ruin in a version, perhaps, of what Michel Foucault has termed an archaeology of knowledge. And what fragments of discourse, then, one may ask, to use Foucault's language and archaeological metaphor, does one discover the foundations of Fraser's great reputation for authority? Authority among scholars and men of letters, poets and novelists, statesmen and politicians, liberal churchmen and free thinkers, and general readers from all walks of life. I have chosen here only a few such fragments, and which the most complete comes from the address presented to Fraser by a Houseman to inaugurate these lectures some 70 years ago. Houseman made some play with the idea that Fraser himself was a magician, the king of the wood and the custodian, as well as the author of The Golden Bough. There, Houseman continued at some length, we find learning mated with literature, labour disguised as ease, and a museum of dark and uncouth superstitions invested with the charm of a truly sympathetic magic. There you have gathered together for the admonition of a proud and oblivious race, the scattered and fading relics of its foolish childhood, whether withdrawn from our view from among savage folk or lying unnoticed at our doors. I must go on with it. The forgotten milestones of the road which man has travelled, the mazes and blind alleys of his appointed progress through time, are illuminated by your art and genius, and the strangers of remote and ancient things are brought near to the minds and hearts of your contemporaries. It is some indication of the impression Fraser made on his readers that this eulogy takes on the cadences of Fraser's own rhetorical language. Houseman spoke on the whole for the educated middle class connected with the older universities, though by no means all academics, and his praise reflects their interests, their respect for learning, their literary culture, their national pride, their relationship with colonised peoples and with their own working classes, their belief in progress, their concern with their own social origins, and their taste for historical legend and classical mythology. Fraser wrote of the magician as the wisest and most intelligent of his tribe, who was therefore chosen as its leaders. His admirers fancifully cast him in that role himself, as a repository of their myth and legend, a magician, a seer, or a prophet. And Fraser was happy to accept that role. As early as 1901, Wickham Steed, who became the editor of the Times, wrote to Fraser after meeting him in Rome. William James, who had met him there at the same time, had found him a sucking babe of humility, unworldliness, and a mole-like sightlessness to everything but print. But Wickham Steed saw him differently. "My dear Fraser," his letter begins, "it seems rather like a profanation to drop the mister to an arch-magician like you." And R.R. Marriott went further, referring, if mischievously, to the very formidable Lady Fraser as the Flaminica Dialis, the wife of the priest of Jupiter. Jane Harrison spoke for the avant-garde classicists, Gilbert Murray and later E.R. Dodds, whose interest in the Greeks and the irrational was in part suggested by reading Fraser. "The classicists were blind," Jane Harrison wrote, "until Fraser came to light the dark wood of superstition with a gleam from the Golden Bough. At the mere sound of the magical words Golden Bough, the scales fell from our eyes. We heard and understood." And many less academic readers found inspiration in the Golden Bough. Professor Fleur goes out of his way to mention a miner in South Wales for whom the Golden Bough was a treasured possession. Downey quotes Jane Harrison's account of her meeting with a cultured policeman, I quote, "a member of the Working Men's College, who said, 'I used to believe everything they told me, but thank God I read the Golden Bough, and I've been a free thinker ever since.'" On the other hand, a liberal clergyman, the Reverend Montagu Pollock, wrote to Fraser that the Golden Bough, as I quote, "wonderfully confirmative of one's faith in the inner validity of the Holy Scriptures. Only to one who, like yourself, can see and hear is the deep truth revealed." In relation to Fraser's anti-clerical and basically anti-religious views, Sir Francis Galton congratulated him on the cleverness, he said, with which you indicate, without expressing conclusions at all, to wound the feelings of simple orthodox persons. For Fraser was all things to all men. Hard-headed, if liberal-minded, colonial officials welcomed his anthropology as a contribution to humane and well-informed administration. Well-informed administration. Oh, yeah. The statesmanship This is from, yes, citizenship may profitably go to school with anthropology, said Sir Frederick White, President of the Indian Assembly. And much of the British field research in the first half of this century was carried out under such auspices as those of General Smuts, for example, or Sir Hubert Murray, Gilbert's brother, the governor of Papua. To these proconsuls, Fraser was able to argue persuasively on their own ground for the funding of anthropological research as a moral duty of imperial rule. Many different from such men of affairs were provincial antiquarians, represented at their most charming, I think, in a letter from a Mr. J. Parrott of Stockton-on-Tees, who wrote, I think, a book on ancient lamps. At that time, when the letter was written in 1901, at that time, with the death of Queen Victoria, the crisis of a royal succession, which of course sent for the Golden Bough, filled the British newspapers. For many of us, well, for me certainly, the letter may still strike a sympathetic chord. Dear Sir, your books always fill me with an indescribable rest, carrying me away from all the dreary intercourse of daily life. Not that my life is unhappy, it is increasingly joyous since that event which your first edition of the Golden Bough came to commemorate, my marriage. That was the opening of the golden gate into the most delightful portion of my life. You'll understand me better when I say that I am not a newspaper reader, and the flotsam and jetsam of public opinion passes without effect on me, for I would sooner be concerned with the finding of a new fact about primitive man and fire, or the discoverer of a fire-split flint, than share all the dreary intercourse of parliamentary, municipal, and social life. Naive, perhaps, Mr. Parrott's letter may seem, but it is revealing in that it touches upon a pervading sense of discontent with their own modern civilization, a longing for other places and other times, which also troubled the poets of the early 19th and early 20th century. Fraser understood this very well, and to some extent he shared it. The language and apocalyptic vision of the Bible, he wrote, lifts us above the dull round of common life. And he was always nostalgic for Cambridge, where, as you will agree, remote from the tumult and bustle of the world, with its pomps, vanities, and ambitions, the student may hope to penetrate through little transitory questions of the hour to the realities which abide. World-weary readers like Mr. Parrott had already been well prepared for Fraser's voyage of discovery and by the poets they most admired. Wordsworth, for example, with his wish to exchange the worldly materialism of his own society for the spiritual vitality of a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. Matthew Arnold's Scholar Gypsy, escaping to the wild world of Bagley Wood from that strange disease of modern life, this is quoting Arnold, with its sick hurry, its divided aims, its heads o'ertaxed, its palsied hearts. Or there is Tennyson's unhappy hero in Locksley Hall, dreaming of the sensuous pleasures of a tropical island. I quote, "There methinks would be enjoyment more than in this march of mind, in the steamship, in the railway, in the thoughts that shake mankind. There the passions cramped no longer shall have scope and breathing space. I will take some savage woman, she shall rear my dusky race." Fraser himself, of course, had no appetite for any such exotic experience. Downey tells one of several similar, probably apocryphal stories of how as a child he had fled howling with terror from the wild man of Borneo at a fairground. And in his prime, he readily found good reasons for not accompanying A.C. Hatton on an expedition to New Guinea. But for those who felt, with Mr. Parrott, alienated from their own civilization, the Golden Bough came as a compendium and a vicarious experience of other ways of thinking and feeling, older, more deeply rooted in human nature, and rich in symbolic content. Hence, Eliot, Pound, Lawrence and Yeats, to mention only the best known, used Fraser's anthropology to criticise the spiritual impoverishment of a civilisation dominated by applied science. An old bitch gone in the teeth, a botched civilisation, as Pound called it. For them, what Fraser had intended as a sustained critique of human irrationality in effect helped to restore the irrational, or at least the non-rational, to its place in artistic creativity. Fraser, as usual ambivalent, had made allowance for such a reaction, contrasting, for example, Renan's understanding of religious emotion with the arid rationalism of the German theologian Feuerbach. There was indeed something for everybody in Fraser's anthropology. It strengthened Yeats's magical and theosophical beliefs, deepened Eliot's understanding of Christian spirituality, and conversely directed D.H. Lawrence away from his residual Christianity towards his search for his own dark gods. For Eliot, the Golden Bough was a great artistic expression of religious disillusionment. He says, in language rather strange for such an austere critic as Eliot, throbbing with the agony of spiritual life. D.H. Lawrence followed Fraser's savages to New Mexico, where they freed him, he wrote, from the great era of material and mechanical development, the great psyche of materialism and idealism which dominated me. There again, Fraser had anticipated those who might regret the replacement of the old gods by what Fraser called, because he was a scientist, certain abstract ideas of ether, atoms, molecules, and so forth. Thus, instead of being peopled, this is Fraser, that instead of being peopled with a bustling crowd of full-blooded and picturesque deities animated by the warm passions of humanity, the universe outside our narrow circle of consciousness is now conceived as absolutely silent, colourless and deserted. So, the gods which Fraser felt sadly obliged to dethrone in the name of science were restored by the poets in the name of sensibility, in the name of Christian or pagan spirituality, of intuition, of imagination, of instinct. Paradoxically then, perhaps, it was Fraser's most lasting achievement. I don't know how the timing of that has gone. It's gone rather quickly. Is that about right?